Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, May 16, 2023. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, Building Codes, this story by Marissa Payne. Whether it's the hurricane-force winds of the 2020 derecho, or the destructive rising Cedar River waters of the 2008 flood, Linn County is no stranger to disasters. To avoid massive damage to buildings and keep residents safe as severe weather events increase in frequency, building codes have had to improve over time to stand up to the growing threats brought on by the climate crisis. Representatives from Linn County's Planning and Development Department met with sixth grade students at Roosevelt Creative Corridor Business Academy on Friday to teach Cedar Rapids youth about the role building codes play in infrastructure stability during natural disasters. This lesson coincided with Building Safety Month, which both the City of Cedar Rapids and Linn County are celebrating. Students learned about different types of natural disasters and how to build commercial and residential structures that can withstand the disasters or curb their effects. Linn County staff service eight cities, with one more to be added soon, as well as unincorporated Linn County. They ensure buildings are built in compliance with building code, the mandatory set of rules on building design, construction, testing, inspection, and maintenance to protect public health, safety, and welfare. Cities such as Cedar Rapids have their own building services department, which has jurisdiction over properties within city limits. County Associate Combination Inspector Ryan Sampica reviewed the history of codes, basic codes, and how the county performs damage assessments and collects data after disasters for the Federal Emergency Management Agency to aid in the recovery process. He identified examples of disasters and how they influenced changes in building codes over time. He shared with the students how inspectors took the code and other factors to inspect instructions to make them safe. Simply put, Sampica told students, building code is to help you be safe in whatever building you're in, whether it's a school, a home, or a mall. That's what our job is as building inspectors. It's to come out and make sure that whatever building is being built will be safe and will protect you in case of some sort of natural disaster, Sampica said. The first known building code dates back to approximately 1750 BC, with the Code of Hammurabi, one of the earliest and most complete written legal codes. It was proclaimed by King Hammurabi, who reigned over the Old Babylonian Empire from 1792 to 1750 BC. That code was quite simple, though, Sampica said, essentially dictating that if a house fell, for example, it should be rebuilt at no cost to the occupant. Over time, events occurred that prompted codes to be strengthened. After a Roman amphitheater collapsed, killing tens of thousands of spectators at the packed venue in AD 27, Sampica said Roman lawmakers required all amphitheaters to be built on solid foundation, inspected, and certified. Another example he provided was the 6.7 magnitude Northridge earthquake in 1994 in Southern California, which caused damage up to 85 miles from its epicenter. Many buildings in that disaster were crushed because they lacked proper reinforcement, he said, but now there's rebar in the walls to make concrete stronger so it will hold up to such an event. Most recently, Sampica used the derecho as an example. The costliest thunderstorm in U.S. history caused $7.5 billion in damage across Iowa, with sustained wind gusts of 115 miles per hour and gusts up to 140 miles per hour. There was minimal structural damage caused by high wind speeds along in the derecho, Sampica said. Rather, much of the damage to properties was caused by trees the ferocious winds toppled, a testament to the advancement of building codes over centuries. That's how far our codes have come to make these buildings safe, Sampica said. The fact that we had that and didn't have a lot of structural damage, that's impressive, and that's why the codes work. As an example of how Linn County uses building code, building official Luke Maloney told the Gazette code allows for project planners to request reductions to the maximum wind speed projects are designed to withstand. He said NextEra requested a wind speed reduction for its utility-scale Duane Arnold solar project near Palo, but that request was denied because the community has already experienced a disaster with high winds. Science teacher Valerie Sampica, whose class hosted the county guests, said this is the first full year that students get educated in science. To finish the year, students are learning about earth science, everything from geological processes and changes in the earth over time to natural hazards around the U.S. With a magnet school, she said, there's an effort to incorporate project-based learning into curriculum. So she assigned a project giving students a city to research. They will study its location, what hazards it faces, and how communities might implement processes to keep citizens safe from those threats. They're enjoying this unit, she said. They're getting involved, and I'm trying to do a lot more hands-on activities. I just want to end the year giving them something to look forward to, momentum, into seventh grade. Several students had questions about the building inspector's work. What does zoning mean? How much do building inspectors make? What inspired you to do this? And if a building falls, whose fault is it? Despite Ryan Sampica's sales pitch for the profession, at least one of the students wasn't quite ready to ditch his dreams of becoming an athlete. You'd rather be a professional soccer player, said Principal Justin Bleets, who sat in on the presentation. If that doesn't work, this might be a good alternative. Also on the front page this morning, this story by Tom Barton, How to Apply for Private School Assistance. State officials have scheduled a series of webinars to teach Iowans about how to apply for state-funded financial assistance to attend a private school in the 2023-24 school year. Applications for students' first education savings accounts will be accepted starting May 31 through June 30. The program, signed into law by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds in late January, after being passed by the Republican-led Iowa legislature early this year, will be phased in over 4 years until, at full implementation, all K-12 students in Iowa will be eligible for roughly $7,600 per year in state funding to put towards private school tuition or other private school expenses. The State Board of Education adopted administrative rules on May 4 that specified definitions for the program, eligibility requirements, parameters for the application process, and program administration and accountability. The program is expected to cost $107 million in the first year and $345 million by 2027 when fully implemented. In total, over the course of 4 years, the program would cost the state an estimated $879 million. A New York-based company, Odyssey, that administers similar programs in other states has been contracted by Iowa to operate the program. The legislation was approved with only Republican support. They said the program will give greater choice for families in their child's education. Democrats and critics of the program say it will divert state funding from public schools and will disproportionately benefit higher-income families. A spokesperson for the Iowa Department of Education did not respond to messages and emailed questions seeking clarification about the information that will be presented in the series of webinars for parents and guardians of Iowa K-12 students. Since the education savings accounts were signed into law, some private schools have announced increases in their tuition fees for the coming year. Reynolds, speaking during an appearance on Iowa Press, recorded Thursday at the Iowa PBS studios in Johnston, said she does not feel that reports of some Iowa private schools increasing tuitions weakens the state's new financial assistance program, but she said she'll keep an eye on it. Reynolds told reporters that private institutions are facing the same increased costs in education that public schools are. She added, private school teachers in Iowa often make less than public school teachers, and that tuition increases could go toward teacher salaries. And we should be doing that across the board, and that's one of the things I'll be working on next year, Reynolds said. Iowa public school teachers make less than the national average. Iowa K-12 public school teachers made an average of $59,581 last fiscal year, according to data from the National Education Association. The national average public school teacher salary in 2021-22 was $66,745. The average teacher starting salary in Iowa was $39,208. Reynolds said that gap is why she introduced a provision in the ESA program allowing public schools to use unspent categorical funds to increase teacher salaries. Parents and guardians who choose to enroll their child in an accredited non-public school will receive an amount equal to the per-pupil funding allocated to public school districts for each eligible child. The per-pupil funding for the 2023-24 school year will be $7,635. Half of the money will be available to pay tuition and approved expenses for the fall semester, and the remaining half will be available for the spring. Funds will be deposited into an educational savings account to be used for tuition, fees, and other qualified education expenses. The money cannot be used to pay preschool tuition. ESA funds must be used for kindergarten through 12th grade. Education at an accredited private school in Iowa. That includes an online private school, provided the student is enrolled full-time and the school is accredited through the Iowa Department of Education. So, who is eligible? In year one, all kindergarten students, all public school students, private school students at or below the 300% of the federal poverty level, and that is $90,000 for a family of four. In year two, 2024-25, all kindergarten students, all public school students, and private school students at or below the 400% of the federal poverty level, that will be updated in January of 2024. And in year three, 2025-26, all K-12 students in Iowa, regardless of income, are eligible. The Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency predicts that 14,068 students will be enrolled in the program in fiscal 2024, its first year. That includes an estimated 4,841 students who would transfer from a public school to a non-public school. By fiscal 2027, the agency expects 41,687 students in Iowa to receive educational savings accounts to pay their private school costs. Over that time, the agency projects enrollment in public schools to drop from 486,476 in fiscal 2024 to 475,207 in fiscal 2027. Students must be enrolled full-time and attend classes for at least 75% of the full-time schedule. The application process is in development, according to the Iowa Department of Education's website. Iowa families may begin applying for the education savings accounts on May 31st. Applications will be due on June 30 for next school year. Applications are valid for 1 year, and a family must apply annually to remain eligible for the program, according to the state's Students First Education Savings Account website. The Iowa Department of Education has created a website with answers to frequently asked questions. Parents and guardians can also email studentsfirst@iowa.gov, or you can call 515-281-5211 for more information. Also on the front page today, this story by the Gazette staff and Wires is titled, Iowan Backs World's Biggest Plant for Ethanol Jet Fuel. Honeywell and Iowa-based Summit Agriculture are partnering to build the world's largest plant making ethanol-based aviation fuel, a project that is likely to become a $1 billion facility and expected to open in 2025. The plant eventually will produce enough jet fuel to power thousands of flights per year, according to Summit Agricultural, run by Iowa entrepreneur Bruce Rastetter. The facility will be located on the U.S. Gulf Coast and use Honeywell's technology to transform ethanol into sustainable aviation fuel, known as SAF, the company said on Monday. The global aviation market demands more than 100 billion gallons of jet fuel annually, with Summit estimating that figure will double in the next 20 years. At the same time, airlines across the globe are coming under pressure to decrease their carbon dioxide emissions. The Biden administration has announced a goal for SAF to meet 100% of aviation fuel demand by 2050. But annual production in the United States was just 15 million gallons in 2022. Monday's announcement marks one of many steps private companies and governments have taken recently to bolster the market for the corn-based biofuel, which the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association said in 2021 accounted for over $5 billion of Iowa GDP, generated $2.6 billion of income for Iowa households, and supported nearly 46,000 jobs in the state's economy. Last month, the Biden administration announced that a higher blend of the ethanol, called E15, can be sold during this summer's driving season. The blend is generally prohibited in the summer because of environmental concerns. More than 300 Iowa gas stations offer E15, and that is likely to rise under a law Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signed last year, mandating most gas stations in the state offer E15 by 2026. In the 2023 fiscal year so far, the state has awarded over $5.7 million to 119 biofuels infrastructure projects, including $800,000 awarded last week that includes 12 projects at gas stations, one in Cedar Rapids, to add E15 infrastructure to be able to comply with that new law. But perhaps the most controversial effort to boost the market for ethanol is the construction of underground pipelines meant to capture the CO2 emissions of ethanol plants and sequester them underground. Critics say the pipelines are unproven and pose risks to people and the environment. But beyond that, two of the three pipeline projects proposed for Iowa, which would generate federal tax credits, are asking the state for eminent domain power to be able to force easements from reluctant landowners. Rastetter runs one of the pipeline companies, Summit Carbon Solutions, and is seeking permission of the state's regulators for its approximately 680-mile route in Iowa, and also for eminent domain authority. The Summit route also runs through Nebraska, Minnesota, South and North Dakota, where it would sequester the liquefied CO2. Ethanol plants that participate in carbon capture will have access to significant new markets like this, both here in the U.S. and abroad, Rastetter wrote Monday in an email to Iowa legislators. We continue to believe that embracing new opportunities and markets will prove to be incredibly beneficial for Iowa agriculture. It's hard not to be incredibly bullish on Iowa agriculture given the opportunities in front of biofuels going forward. Summit said it is in talks that about providing SAF supplies to major airlines and freight companies. The Alden-based Summit Agricultural founded FS Biogenaria, the largest corn-based ethanol platform in Brazil. Amber Wave, a food ingredients and biofuel plant in Kansas, and Summit Carbon Solutions, which is planned to connect more than 30 ethanol plants in the upper Midwest. The jet fuel project is a natural extension for the partner plants in the United States that will use the proposed Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline to decarbonize the ethanol production, said Summit Ag Investors President Justin Kirchhoff. The SAF plant will be in a unique position given its location on the Gulf Coast to use a variety of ethanol feedstocks from different locations. It was not clear Monday how much of that would come from Iowa. We can produce a net negative carbon fuel in the U.S., and the only feedstock that has enough growth potential to make a difference on SAF is ethanol, said Rastetter. The plant will be Honeywell's first ethanol SAF deal, licensing its technology. Airlines will need to expand the feedstocks used to make fuel to include corn, because there's not enough being made from fats or oils alone to meet the decarbonization goals for the airlines, said Barry Glickman, Vice President and General Manager of Honeywell Sustainable Technology Solutions. Moving to some Iowa Today news, this story is by Tom Barton. Iowa seniors and vets can apply for new property tax break. Iowa seniors and veterans can begin applying for a new property tax break created by legislation signed into law earlier this month by Governor Kim Reynolds. The new property tax law, House File 718, was approved with near unanimous support in the Iowa legislature. The bill is designed to limit the amount of new property tax revenue growth that local governments can use in their budgets. Republican legislative leaders estimated the legislation will result in a $100 million property tax cut statewide. It also provides new property tax exemptions for Iowans age 65 and older and for military veterans. The law provides a $3,250 exemption on the taxable value of a home owned and lived in by Iowans 65 and older as of January 1st of this year. The exemption applies for the 2023 assessment year that would have associated taxes due in the fall of 2024 and the spring of 2025. The homestead property tax exemption increases to $6,500 for the 2024 assessment year. The exemption is a reduction in the taxable value of the property, not a direct reduction in the amount of property tax owed. And that is in addition to the Iowa Homestead Tax Credit, which reduces the taxable value of an owner-occupied Iowa home up to $4,850. People in the military or in nursing homes who do not occupy the home are also eligible. The Iowa Department of Revenue announced Monday it has amended the Homestead Tax Credit exemption form to allow seniors to apply for the new exemption. Applications are due July 1 to local assessor offices. Forms are available at tax.iowa.gov by searching for Homestead PDF. If granted, the exception will be allowed for future years without future filing as long as the claimant continues to qualify, according to the department. Unlike the Iowa Homestead Tax Credit, however, local governments will not be backfilled for the loss in revenue from this part of the new law. The new law also more than doubles a property tax exemption for veterans by increasing it to $4,000 in taxable value from the current $1,852. As with seniors, applications are due July 1 to the local assessor. However, military veterans currently receiving the exemption do not need to file a new application as long as the veteran or the veteran's spouse is the legal or equitable owner of the property on July 1, for which the exemption is allowed, said John Fuller, a spokesperson for the Iowa Department of Revenue. The exemption applies for a honorably separated, retired, furloughed to a reserve, placed on inactive status, or discharged veteran. Lawmakers passed the bill shortly after the latest round of property assessments across Iowa showed widespread dramatic increases in the assessed value of homes, up a statewide average of 22% this year. To keep the rise from triggering dramatic increases in homeowners' local property tax bills. While calling the bill the most significant property tax reform in state history, Reynolds and GOP lawmakers have said the measure is just the first step in addressing property taxes. They intend to revisit the issue during next year's legislative session. Turning to the Insight page, the guest column today is written by Nicholas Johnson. We must make Iowa great again. Our country arose out of the ashes of authoritarianism. The Declaration of Independence charged the King of Great Britain as having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. Yet our founders knew, as John Quincy Adams wrote, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. Curious about how this happens? Read Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt's How Democracies Die. A law school colleague, when frustrated by students' silence, would ask, "Is anybody listening? Does anybody care?" Polls reveal a significant percentage of Americans neither listen nor care. They say a populist, authoritarian ruler is preferable to democracy. They believe their needs are neither recognized nor addressed by a democracy ruled by a wealthy elite because they're not. Republicans have played the populism card with duplicity and skill. Democrats fought against their own most effective pro-democracy populist, Bernie Sanders. We have two national governments, the executive and legislative bodies in Washington, and the governors and legislatures in 50 states. Some of them are weakening democracy with strategies from the authoritarians' playbook. Consider Iowa. The consolidation of power from the people, cities, state agencies, and legislators into the governor's office. Political ideology governing hires and judicial appointments. Restricting access to public information, tax breaks, and curtailed regulation for major donors. From 1969 to 1983, Iowans kept reelecting another conservative Republican, Governor Robert Ray. Ray's accomplishments would more than fill this column. Here are a few. Public employees' collective bargaining, Commission on the Status of Women, Iowa Council on Children, eliminating sales tax on food and drugs, Department of Environmental Quality, expanded funding for K-12 schools, making Iowa first in the nation to protect Native Americans' graves. Ray held daily news conferences, was pro-choice before Roe, and opposed the death penalty. He personally lobbied the President and Secretary of State to change the law, enabling Iowa to welcome refugees from Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Thailand, the first state to do so. Ray realized democracy requires more than constitutions and laws. It requires the norms of behavior essential to its survival, especially mutual tolerance and institutional forbearance. It requires the civic society, the nonpartisan organizations and coalitions Tocqueville observed in 1835, an awareness that hate is not a policy and should not be a political strategy. We must turn to ourselves to rebuild the civic society it requires. If Linn County can bring together a variety of the world's religions in its interreligious council, think of what other coalitions are possible. Edward R. Murrow courageously exposed authoritarian Senator Joseph McCarthy in a See It Now on March 9, 1954. McCarthy, he concluded, had exploited our fear. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. And Nicholas Johnson is the author of Columns of Democracy. He can be reached at mailbox@nicholasjohnson.org. And one community letter today, Democrats could reduce spending, deficit, and debt. The enormous issue labeled as the debt ceiling has been presented to us in a false way that is characteristic of politics in our time. On one side, Democrats favor paying the debts that the U.S. government has incurred. None of us can get away with not paying our debts without dire consequences, which would be devastating in the U.S. case. The other side of the debate, where Republicans threaten to vote to default on the debt, if their chosen list of cuts in spending are not passed, is where the confusion exists. This side is a one-sided argument that has been successful at scoring partisan political points. Regarding spending, the Democratic point of view is missing. Really, various Democrats favor things like cutting military spending, cutting fossil fuel subsidies, cutting EQIP subsidies for CAFOs, and ending farm subsidies by restoring adequate price floors and supply management. They also favor raising the minimum wage to a living wage, which would greatly reduce the need for food subsidies. In addition to all this, Democrats like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren favor making the rich pay a fairer share of taxes, which could greatly reduce taxes for the rest of us. These changes could significantly pay down the deficit and debt and reduce the needed increase in the debt ceiling. Paying our debts is the only rational solution. Democrats don't mention how they would also reduce spending much more rationally and favorably than what the Republicans propose. That letter today is sent by Brad Wilson from Springville. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, May 16, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page, and we begin with the short notices from Amana. Vernon, known as Buck Pickerel, age 91, died Saturday, May 13, Cedar Memorial Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. Two notices from Cedar Rapids. Travis John Hurley, age 36, died Friday, May 12, Bross Chapel and the Ava Center. Also, Mary Jean Kachera, age 101, of Des Moines, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, May 15, Bross Chapel and the Ava Center. In Coggin, Philip F. Shatsley, age 89, died Sunday, May 14, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Central City. In Marion, Leslie Williams, age 60, died Monday, May 15, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service. From Postville, Jereen Robin Arney, age 68, died Saturday, May 13, Schutte Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service. In Spillville, Agnes Sukup, 90, died Sunday, May 14, Helms Funeral Home, Decorah. In Vinton, Melvin Hurst, Jr., 69, died Saturday, May 13, Van Steehuis Tien Funeral Home. And in Waterloo, Catherine L. Walker, age 78, died March 31st, Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home, Olwine. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Mount Vernon, David Ewer Van Meter passed away in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on May 11 after a long and valiant cancer battle. A memorial service may be planned for later this summer. David would have appreciated a tree or greenery be planted in his memory, or alternatively, a donation to a local Boys and Girls Club of America. Please share your support and memories with Dave's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. In Cedar Rapids, Tartorius, known as Tory Allen Sr., 47, passed away May 5. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. Friday, May 19 at St. Paul's United Methodist, located at 1340 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Homegoing services will begin at 1 p.m. Friday, May 19 at St. Paul's United Methodist Church. Bross Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is in charge of arrangements. From Manchester, Ernest John, known as Ernie Toll, age 87, passed away Monday, May 15, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. Online condolences can be sent to leonardmullerfuneralhome.com. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Friday, May 19, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Manchester, with Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Visitation is 3 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 18, at Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. Friends may also call Friday from 9:45 to 10:45 at the church. Interment will be at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Manchester. In Cedar Rapids, Eunice Mary McGrath of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Dubuque, passed away at the age of 89, Tuesday, May 9th, at Gardens of Cedar Rapids Assisted Living Facility. Bear's Funeral Home in Dubuque is assisting the family with arrangements. Eunice's daughters will greet friends from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 16th at Bear's, 1491 Main Street in Dubuque. A private graveside service and burial will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Eunice was preceded in death by her parents and two sons, Troy McGrath and Paris McGrath Capulet. In Iowa City, Helen A. Gustafson Ringenberg died May 10 under the compassionate care of Oak Knoll Healthcare and Iowa City Hospice. She was 98 years old. Helen's body was donated to the University of Iowa Deeded Body Program. A memorial service to celebrate Helen's life is scheduled for Friday, June 16th at 10 a.m. at St. Andrew's Presbyterian in Iowa City. Visitation will begin at 9 a.m. for 1 hour prior to the service. To share a thought, memory, or condolence, visit Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service website. In Cedar Rapids, John Edward Siepman, 70, died Sunday, May 14, at his home. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday at Gloria Dei Lutheran Church by Reverend Trish Decker. Friends may visit with the family from 9 to 10:45 a.m. on Thursday at the church. Tian Funeral Home is serving the family. In Cascade, Karen P. Fangman Kelchin, age 80, of Cascade, passed away after a hard-fought battle with Alzheimer's on Friday, May 12. The family of Karen will greet friends and relatives from 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, May 20, at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade, where a mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. with the Reverend Douglas Locke presiding and the Reverend Mark Osterhaus concelebrating. Burial will be held in Calvary Cemetery in Cascade. The Reef Funeral Home in Cascade is assisting the family with arrangements. In Marion, Wava Bach, age 98, passed away peacefully May 14 at the Views of Marion. A visitation will be held from 10 a.m. until time of graveside service at 11 a.m. Friday, May 19th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Online condolences can be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. In Marion, Patricia Lee, known as Pat Ogden, daughter of the late Vincent Perry and Thelma, known as Skip Donahue, died surrounded by her three children at 2305 Prairie Hill Drive in Marion on May 13 due to Alzheimer's disease and a cardiac condition. She was 79 years old. A celebration of life will be held for Pat at Sally's on Broadway in Springville, Iowa, at a date and time to be determined. In Cedar Rapids, Shelley K. Wilder, age 62, passed away due to health complications May 2nd at Living Care West, Cedar Rapids. A graveside service will be held Thursday, May 18th at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will be held after the service at CJ's Sports Bar and Grill with family, friends, and food. From Cedar Falls, Wayne Roland Merchant, age 88, passed away Monday, May 8, surrounded by his family, survived by his wife Barbara and children. Private family celebration of life services are planned and memorials may be directed to the family. From Center Junction, Ryan Scott Tonges died unexpectedly in his sleep Friday, May 12. Funeral services will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, May 19th at the Wayne Zion Lutheran Church in rural Monticello. Friends may call from 4 until 7 p.m. Thursday at the Getch Funeral Home. Pastor Wade Reddy will officiate at the services. Interment will be at Oakwood Cemetery, Monticello. By visiting GetchOnline.com, you can share your thought, memory, and condolence with Ryan's family. From Cedar Rapids, Mary Pauline Hook, age 89, passed away May 12 at home with her family. Visitation 5 to 8 p.m. Wednesday, May 17th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home with a vigil service and rosary at 5 p.m. Mass of Christian burial is at 10 a.m. Thursday, May 18th at All Saints Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Interment at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Also in Cedar Rapids, Stephen Joseph Henry, age 79, passed away May 11 at his home after a lengthy and courageous battle against cancer. A visitation will be held on Sunday, May 12 from 11 a.m. until time of funeral service at 1 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment with military honors will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. And lastly, from Cedar Rapids, Wayne Burns, age 52, passed away Friday, May 12, at home. He fought a tough battle with esophageal cancer. No services are planned. Memorials can be made to the family, and you may share your thoughts and memories with Wayne's family at stuartbaxter.com. Turning now to some sports news in high school girls golf, Cedar Rapids Prairie's Addie Berg captured what eluded her the last two seasons. This time, her performance was sufficient to earn top honors. Berg tied for fourth with a 79 at the Mississippi Valley Conference Mississippi Division meet. That was held Monday at Twin Pines Golf Course. The effort was good enough for a three-round total of 235, earning MVC Mississippi Player of the Year honors. "I'm pretty excited," Berg said. "It was nice to put together three semi-good rounds, and it was good enough to get there. It's cool to be able to say you won conference one time, even though it's not the biggest deal. It's a fun little thing, so I'm pretty happy about it." And in high school baseball, the Bobcats start the season on top. Western Dubuque will begin the season exactly where it left off last year. The defending Class 3A champion received top billing in the preseason rankings, and the early tag is met with perspective. "We were given this ranking based off last year," Western Dubuque coach Casey Bryant said. "Now we know we have to go prove our ranking this year." Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association released its preseason rankings Monday for all four classes. Western Dubuque is joined by West Des Moines Dowling in 4A, Van Meter in 2A, and Remsen St. Mary's in 1A as top-ranked teams. The Bobcats finished 32-11 last season, capturing the school's first state baseball crown. They opened the season last night at Iowa City Liberty. The MVC has six ranked teams in the two biggest classes. Cedar Rapids Prairie is fourth in 4A after falling to Dowling in last year's state quarterfinal. Cedar Rapids Kennedy, which lost to Prairie in the sub-state final, is seventh, and Iowa City High was a 2022 state semifinalist and starts the season ranked ninth. Add in number six Dubuque Wallert in 3A and some other capable teams in the conference. Every game is a challenge. "The MVC is going to be really good," Bryant said. "It's going to depend on what day of the week you play and the pitching matchups." Mid Prairie, a state semifinalist last season, starts number two in 2A. Dyersville Beckman begins a new era under coach Ryan Mabe, and in the River Valley Conference is ranked fourth. Williamsburg and Cascade round out the area teams in 2A at number six and number nine. Perennial Power North Lynn is ranked third in 1A, and Lisbon is one spot behind. Turning to the community page, here are some things to do today. Welcome to Medicare. Will you be eligible for Medicare in the near future? Do you know your options for receiving Medicare benefits? Do you want to better understand how Medicare works with other health insurance options? This two-hour seminar is offered by Senior Health Insurance Information Program Counselors. It takes place at the Samuel and Emma Ranshaw House, 515 Community Drive in North Liberty, today from 5 to 7 p.m., and that is free. And this Eastern Iowa brief is from Iowa City. The Johnson County Master Gardeners will host its 14th annual plant sale and flea market from 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday at the Johnson County Fairgrounds at Buildings B and C, 4261 Oak Crest Hill, Northeast in Iowa City. Organizers say the event is growing bigger and better than ever. The biggest draw for garden shoppers are the plants grown exclusively by master gardeners. The sale and market have expanded into two buildings at the Johnson County Fairgrounds, said sale coordinator Emil Ridensbacher. A contributing factor is our plant sale and flea market was paused for 2 years during the pandemic, while the number of people gardening has grown exponentially. Shoppers will find a range of perennial flowers, vegetables and herbs, shrubs and woody plants, as well as flea market items and gift selections available for sale. Shoppers may also select unique gifts at the Butterfly House silent auction. The Butterfly House is open to the public during the Johnson County 4-H and FFA fair. The flea market has garden items made available through estate donations. Shoppers will find previously owned garden tools, plant containers, equipment, yard art, books, and other items. Proceeds from the annual plant sale and flea market support Johnson County Master Gardener programs and operations, Kirkwood Community College Horticulture Scholarships, and 4-H Awards. And also on the community play page, this article is called A Quiet Place by Diana Nolan. When the notion of motion, sights, and sounds gets to be too much, the Family Sanctuary offers a quiet oasis inside the Iowa Children's Museum at Coralville's Coral Ridge Mall. The room has been there pretty much since the museum opened, November 16, 1999, said Jeff Capps, executive director. But now the space, measuring 18 feet by 12 feet, has been spruced up to help calm down guests with sensory sensitivities or offer nursing moms a private space in which to feed their babies. We always felt like it was a space that was valuable and a space that we felt good about having, but it just felt like it no longer really met the needs of most families, Capps said. It was just basically one space where a family could close the door and have maybe a little bit of a moment where you're kind of separated. It certainly served that purpose, but it wasn't the welcoming space we thought it could be. So we intentionally set out to just make it feel more inviting and certainly more calming for those who needed that kind of quiet moment. In this case, sanctuary means a break from everything else and a special, quote unquote, sacred space where you can come with your family and chill or regroup. Take a moment to refresh. If kids get overstimulated in the exhibits, it's a place where they can calm down. The overall tone is mellow with much softer lighting, Capps noted. Overhead lighting is no longer the default lighting. Instead, it's augmented by peace sconces on the walls. We love the fact that they're called peace because we wanted to be a peaceful space, Capps said. We also were very careful to design it with some nice earth tone colors. There's almost like an earth sky kind of feel in there where you walk in and you feel like it's more of a natural space, less of a built environment and a little more of a natural kind of space. It feels like you're in a very peaceful place. Books, a playhouse, a light tube with changing colors, an Aura LED projector and tactile blocks help keep kids of all ages engaged. New seating includes a cozy couch, kid-sized chair and sofa, atop new carpet in various shades of blue. We tried to walk that line, Capps said. We didn't want to become an exhibit because it's not an exhibit, but we also wanted to have some interactive elements that felt very family-friendly for folks when they go into the space. It's also open to guests who don't have someone with special needs, but just want to retreat from all the activity in the exhibits, Capps said. Those who wish to use the room don't have to ask at the information desk or make a reservation. The door doesn't lock, but a window allows guests to see if the room is in use. The renovation cost about $50,000, financed through grants from Variety, the children's charity. the Iowa City AM Rotary Club, and the Rotary Foundation. Another $3,000 paid for installing a size-inclusive changing table, a lockable family restroom down the hall. Even though the table will support up to 400 pounds, Capps said it's still considered a child's changing room, designed for someone just under 5 feet tall, since the room has limited space. In brief, if you go, it is located at the Iowa Children's Museum inside the Coral Ridge Mall, 1451 Coral Ridge Avenue, just inside the Southeast Mall entrance, next to the skating rink and the food court. Hours available are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Tuesday to Sunday. They're closed on Mondays. Admission there is $10 for children and adults, $9 for ages 60 and up, and free if you're under age 1. Finishing up with the top weather story, Cloud Types is the title of this little article by Hannah Messier. When you look into the sky, you'll notice several different types of clouds at different levels of the atmosphere. Clouds high in the sky will have the prefix cirro in front of it to indicate that they occur high in the atmosphere. The feathery, wispy clouds that are seen high in the sky are called cirrus clouds, because cirrus means lock of hair in Latin. Other high-level clouds include cirrostratus and cirrocumulus. Clouds in the middle of the atmosphere oftentimes have the word alto in front of their name, such as altocumulus and altostratus. Most clouds occur in the lowest part of the atmosphere, that's below 6,500 feet. Cumulonimbus, cumulus, and stratocumulus clouds all occur at this level. We are looking for partly cloudy skies today, with a high of 77 in Cedar Rapids and a low of 51. The normal high today is 71. The normal low is 50. We set a record high of 90 degrees in 1992, a record low of 31 in 1997. Mostly sunny tomorrow. A chance of thunderstorms pops up on Thursday and Friday. Sunset tonight is at 8:21 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 5:44 a.m. That gives us 14 hours and 36 minutes of daylight. And we are in the waning crescent moon phase, with moon rise at 4:36 a.m. and moon set at 6:30 p.m. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, May 16, 2023. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a copy of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.